In the meantime, the police have set up several tables and are taking names, addresses, and telephone numbers from the patrons. IDs are checked and each is given a form and an envelope with a list of standard questions. Each is asked if they saw anything that might not have been noticed by others. Some say yes and are sent to different tables where more detailed statements are taken. All are told that they may be contacted for further information. One by one or in pairs or small groups, they leave the club, chattering about the excitement. After about an hour, it's just down to the police and staff. The police interview the staff, give them the same form, and ask if they saw anything out of the ordinary in the lead-up to the incident. David walks over to the table with the chief detective and hands over VCR copies of the digital surveillance files. He has omitted those segments that show the kidnappers entering the club and the detailed close-in scans of Mark and Sid. Instead, only fuzzy, smoke-blurred long shots are provided. As for Harry and Steve, David knows the police will eventually get a make on their fingerprints and that their mugshots will be in the news. David tells the chief detective that he believes Harry and Steve had been there before and thrown out for dealing drugs. David says they were able to identify Harry and Steve from voice prints from the previous episode, but he doesn't know their names. He has surveillance tape of that event included as well. The chief detective is impressed. David explains that it's a fully computerized system. David has one of the guys bring a small 13-inch TV with a built-in VCR to the table with the chief detective. He switches it on and inserts the videotape. They watch the events of earlier in the evening. David pops the tape out of the VCR, puts it back in its case, and hands it to the chief detective, saying, "Any theories other than the obvious?" The chief detective takes the tape and says, too early to make a conclusive determination, but, robbery? Probably some element of payback involved, too. You do a big cash business, I gather. David nods and says, "Quite a lot of cash on a Friday night." From that tape, it appears they may have been high on alcohol or drugs. Autopsy will say for sure. May have been a spur-of-the-moment scheme on their part to get even for before. As to the accomplices who set off the smoke bombs, it wouldn't have been too hard to get some crystal freaks to do that. They do just about anything for a hit. David nods in agreement. Anyway, at this point, it's hard to tell. With those two dead and the ones who started the distraction gone, we probably won't be able to identify the accomplices unless we can ID them from these tapes or someone in the crowd knew them. We don't have much to go on. As to the corpses, the morgue should be able to get a make on them from the fingerprints. They weren't carrying any ID that we could find. Knowing who they are will be a big help. I'll keep you posted. I'm glad none of the crowd was seriously hurt. This could have been a way lot worse. As to the dead meat on the stage, just saves the state the trouble of frying them further down the road. Serves them right for carrying pop bottles full of gasoline. What, so they were going to firebomb the crowd? Jeez, their call, their problem. By the way, I like the laser show your people did on those meatballs' hands. Nothing like state-of-the-art equipment. Sweet. Be a big hit down at headquarters. David says, "I think we'll replay it a few times here, too. Anyway, let me know if there's anything I can do. I don't like people shooting up my club. Right now, however, I think we better deal with that mob of TV people outside. Will you be making a statement?" "Yeah, I'll give them a quick summary, then turn it over to you," says the chief detective, shaking David's hand. It's now about 1 a.m, and the police have finished packing up their cases and left the building. Chapter 6, Saturday, January 13th. Time, 2 a.m. By 2 a.m., the crowds of cops and press have finally cleared out. David, Todd, Jay, Lance, Tom, Bob, and Mike, a few minutes apart, take separate SUVs from the parking lot and rendezvous at an all-night diner several blocks away. After checking that they've not been followed, they then drive to the other side of town. Pulling up to a large garage door at the side of a dingy old flat-roofed cinder-block building, Lance hits a remote control and the door slowly rises. The SUVs pull in and the door noisily rattles down behind them. They are in an old, unheated auto repair shop with stalls for 10 or 15 cars. The walls are cinder-block, painted gray, stained with soot and grease. The windows are dirt-covered, frosted glass set about 10 feet above the floor. The floor itself is marked by blackened grease and the tread marks of many years of use. Old tires are piled in corners. Metal benches are covered with old tools and tattered manuals. Rusted old car parts lie about in the corners. The remnants of posters and old cheesecake calendars hang on the walls. One shop light with two long tubes hangs humming and buzzing above and provides the only light. Mike sees the van with his would-be killers in the middle of the floor directly beneath the shop light. His old car is parked in a stall at the far end of the garage. Tom and Bob's car is next to it. David pulls his SUV to within a few feet of the van. The second SUV stops behind his. Lance gets out and walks over to a metal box mounted on the wall, pulls the cover open and flips some switches. More shop lights flicker on, dim at first in the cold but slowly getting brighter as the tubes begin to warm up. The rest get out of the SUVs at the same time as Lance's guys hop out of their van and circle around to the rear. They unlock and pull open the door and prod out the captives within. They line them up in front of David and his people. The four are stripped to their discount mart underwear and cheap running shoes. Their hands are tightly bound behind their backs. They shiver both in fear and from the sub-zero cold. Their rapid breathing shows in quick puffs of steam. David's people stand in a line opposite and examine the four men before them. They're mainly Midwest street trash, farm boys who thought they could make a few quick bucks in the city. Square chins, dirty blonde hair, blue-eyed, broad-shouldered, muscular, a few tattoos, room-temp IQs, all in their mid to late 20s, none recently shaved. They cautiously glare back at their captors. Lance walks back from the light switches past the row of four when one of the street trash mutters, "Fucking fag." Lance spins around, targets the guy who said it, and menacingly treads towards him. The guy is tall, lots of muscles, stringy, dirty blonde hair, blonde stubble. He spits in Lance's direction and says, in what might be described as a poor choice of words under the circumstances, "Fucking queer." Lance turns and says quietly to one of the bouncers, "Cut him loose, Tony." The bouncer walks over with a set of heavy-duty shears and slices the nylon restraints. The blonde pulls his arms around, massages his wrists, shakes his hands a few times, crouches slightly, arms forward in a wrestling stance, and says, "Okay, fag boy, come and get it." Again, not the best way in which to make friends and win people over. Lance casually walks straight towards him. The blonde lunges. Lance swings slightly to the right, his arm traveling further back, fist clenched, his huge biceps fully flexed, and lets go with a massive gut punch that lifts the lunging blonde up into the air. His feet hit the ground with a thud as he doubles up and staggers backwards. He wobbles, straightens up, and lunges again. Lance's arm is flexed at shoulder height. He pivots back to the right, then slams his clenched fist full force into the oncoming blonde's face. There is a crunching sound and a crack. The blonde's head spins violently to the right as spit, blood, and teeth explode from his mouth. He collapses into a heap of teeth, blood, and grease on the stained cement floor and lies motionless. Lance brandishes his fist at the remaining three and asks, "Anyone else want to say fag?" They noticeably cringe and nervously shake their heads no. The blonde begins to stir, his face flat on the floor. He tries to prop himself up with one arm but fails. Finally, stumbling to his feet, he spits out more blood and teeth. One of the bouncers tosses him a rag and he begins to wipe the blood from his face, now smeared with the black grease as well. Lance looks over at him and sneers, "You want to go a second round?" The blonde painfully shakes his head, his stringy blonde hair now grease-soaked as well, flapping against his blood-stained face. He will always bear the scars of this night. David, looking up and shaking his head, says in a low voice, "Well, besides turning them over to Lance for sparring partners, what do you think, guys? What should we do with them?" asks David. "We need something that'll send a message to the organization not to screw with us." "Why not turn them over to the cops?" says Jay. "No, they got nothing on them, other than maybe an accessory charge for earlier tonight. Anyway, there'd be too many questions about how we caught them, why we didn't turn them in, and why they were at the club, that sort of thing. We need to keep Mike out of the news right now." "No, I think we need to work on our own solution." "Damn it, those freaks are hired killers," says Mike. "Take them out in the farmlands and dump them in a ditch and let them freeze to death. Corpsicles tell no tales." "Nah, that'd be Jack's way of doing business." "Damn right, and these are Jack's minions." "Duh." "No, Mike, calm down. You can't go freezing everybody that wants you dead. I say we just dump them at that first rest stop on I-80 west of town and see if Joe or Pete can fetch them before they freeze, or some horny truckers stuff one or two of them into their Peterbilt sleeper," Lance offers, grinning.
Exactly how much do you know about Peterbilt sleepers?" asks Mike.
Lance pats Mike on the butt and says, "Be happy to show you any time, dude." Mike decides not to ask any more questions. "Okay, besides satisfying Lance's fantasies about 3 days in a truck to Barstow, that's not a bad idea," says David. "Just out of curiosity, exactly how many Peterbilt sleepers have you been in?"
"Oh, give it a rest, will you? It ain't easy being easy, you know," mutters Lance.
"Yeah, Lance might have stumbled on something," says Todd.
"Better yet, dump him and then 911 the highway patrol and tell him it's a bunch of pervs doing lewd acts in a public restroom."
"Yeah, not bad. Maybe call a few TV stations, too. Should make for some nice publicity, the kind their employer won't like. And I want to hear the cover story our boys make up. I don't think the truth will do them much good. And I sure don't think Joe wants his name brought into the picture, if you know what I mean," says David. Looking over at the would-be killers, he continues, "That might have consequences, guys. Very unhealthy consequences. I think you guys got a problem on your hands tonight."
"Yeah, they're totally smoked," says Todd.
They look at one another and back at David, who says, "Okay, if we're all agreed, let them up, Sean. You know the rest stop we're talking about 30 miles west on I-80.
"You bet. No problem," answers Sean. "I think that's the one Lance hangs out at."
"You're a dead man walking, Shawnee," says Lance.
"Probably is, but I hear he works most of them," comments David to Lance's further annoyance.
"When you get there, pull in and dump them fast. Don't wait around, but get a good picture of them lined up in front of the building. I want a souvenir to send to Joe, Pete, and Jack."
"What the fuck is everybody picking on me for?" whines Lance.
"You got it, David. I'll see if there's any messages on the walls for you too, Lance," says Sean as he ducks to avoid a cardboard box Lance hurls his way.